JSA in the 90s. This episode, Justice Society of America number 1, cover dated April 1991. Hello, and welcome to JSA in the 90s, a podcast dedicated to the Justice Society of America and related characters as published in the 1990s. We are a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. My name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I'm not flying solo. Every single episode, we feature a different guest host. My guest host this time dedicated his life to science and helping people by going on to become a doctor. Though, to be honest, I'm pretty sure he just did it to follow in the footsteps of Dr. Midnight. Folks, please help me welcome Dr. Chris Lewis. Welcome to the JSA Brownstone, Chris. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
Hi, Shag. It's been a long time since we've recorded together, so it's lovely to speak to you again. And I am delighted to be asked to join you in discussing the opening episode of this mini-series. This was one of the earliest comics I ever bought. And for the record, I would love to be Dr. Midnight. He is the super medic of the DCU. There's almost nothing he cannot do. On the downside, there is the blindness, but on the positives, pet owl. So, you know, not all bad.
Exactly. And I'm sure you as a medical professional know that bringing a pet owl into an operating theater is perfectly sanitary.
Totally hygienic and absolutely recommended. Yeah.
So I am so excited to be covering this miniseries. Now, folks, if you've been listening for a while, you already know I did this out of order. I covered the 1992 Justice Society series first, simply because I wanted to get to it. Now we're covering the 1991 miniseries, and this is a lot of fun. And the exciting thing is, this is the very first comic book to ever be called Justice Society of America.
Amazing.
Right, I know. There were 50 years. Yeah, and they finally get a comic with their team name. So very exciting to be talking about this. And it's a lot of fun, and we're going to get into a lot of the details of it, but why don't we start off by just talking about some of the promo material going into this. So cast your mind back, folks, to the year 1991, or even late 1990, based on some of these ads, and Chris and I are looking at a house ad. I don't know where this was taken from. I honestly found this advertised on eBay. It's one of those things where, this has nothing to do with the show. I don't care. Whatever. Anyway, on eBay, what they'll do is they'll find a comic ad, they'll cut it out of the comic, and advertise it on eBay as a poster. This happens all the time. It's the such a scam, but it works well for me because they get a really good high resolution scan of the ad. So it's this ad that's laid out. It looks very much like one of the old 1950s ads you would have seen during the Silver Age, or maybe the 60s. And big bold letters, just imagine the mightiest heroes of their time. Starman, Black Canary, Flash, Green Lantern, Hawkman, and there's more exclamation points than you can imagine on this thing, have banded together as the Justice Society of America to stamp out the forces of evil wherever and whenever they appear. The thrilling exploits of these famous champions appear in The New DC. Written by Len Strazewski, drawn by Rick Burchett, Grant Meehan, Mike Parabek, and Tom Artis. Miniseries on sale in early 1991. So this must have been published in a 1990 comic.
Yeah.
So what do you think of this house ad?
This is an amazing find. I had never seen this before. And yeah, I really appreciate the old school look. The coloring, so we've got the cover of this issue, which we'll go on and describe. The coloring in the house ad is a little different to what you get on the actual color. So, you know, the logo's not quite. So maybe I kind of thought maybe it was either a early kind of test coloring, or perhaps it was somebody else just doing it quickly to get it out for the ad. So there is a little bit of difference to the actual cover itself, but it's gloriously retro.
Oh, I love it. It's got, you know, giant, like Just Imagine is huge. Then it's got the Just Society logo. It's got giant swooping arrows and things like that. And even the writing is written very thick to look like the old school ad. I'll post this on social media, folks. It'll also go in the image gallery. It's a lot of fun. Great ad. Now, they also promoted this series in other places, including, and some of you may not even remember this thing exists, there was a pamphlet they used to give away in comic shops called Direct Currents. And it was, I don't know, like a 10-pager sort of thing here.
Yeah.
And this was issue 37, and it says Direct Currents, book shipping in February. And the main cover ad on this particular Direct Currents is Kid Eternity, the Grant Morrison Kid Eternity series, which I do love. Like, I love it far, far too much. In fact, the time I got to meet Grant Morrison, I had him sign the covers of all three of them. But anyway, that's a whole different story. So as you get in here, there is a almost full page, maybe 2/3 of a page, ad for the Justice Society of America series. And it's got a little blurb. Based on the credits inside, I'm going to guess this was written by Paul Kupperberg, but it talks about the miniseries. It gives away the big bad of the entire series, which is interesting. Because they keep him a mystery for like 3-4 issues, and here it's right in the second paragraph. And I'm just going to spoil it for you, folks. I'm sorry if you're reading along, you're going to get spoiled because it's in all the promotional material. So we all were spoiled too. It's Vandal Savage, and
40-year-old spoiler. 40-year-old spoiler. Yeah,
but it tells you his entire plan right here.
Yeah,
you
know? The whole thing. Yeah,
exactly.
No secrets. I know you will get this reference, Shag, but you know the producers of Doctor Who, if they wanted to keep, say, the Daleks a secret, they would say to the Radio Times, the BBC listings magazine, don't mention it, don't put us on the cover. They have not learned this lesson here. They just spill the whole mystery out on one page.
Which, honestly, in rereading issue one makes a little more sense now.
Yeah.
And they photostated in the cover of issue two on there with Black Canary. They've got a panel from issue three with Green Lantern fighting one of the bad guys. So that's nice. And then they give the solicitations, book shipping in February. I'll just read you the solicitations since we've already spoiled it. Justice Society of America number one of an 8-issue limited series. Welcome to 1950, the era of the Justice Society of America, and the year Jay Garrick, the original Flash, became the first member of the JSA to face the wrath of Vandal Savage and the living constellations he plans to use to subjugate humanity. Written by Len Straczynski with art by Rick Burkett, cover by Tom Lyle, $1. So there we go. That is from Direct Currents number 37. I don't have very many of these Direct Currents anymore.
I used to love them. Love these things. And they were great. And like you say, about half of it was a sort of checklist for what was coming out, even with a tick box. So you could go through and tick. But yeah, they didn't come every month to my comic shop, but when I did, they were always a good read and fantastic promotion for DC. You know, here's what's coming up, here's what we want to plug to you. So I thought they were great. I've got some somewhere, but I don't think I've got this one. I love that they number them like a comic book, right? You know, number 37.
Yes.
I have got some tucked away, but I don't think I ever had this one.
And I think the only reason I even have, I think, at least suspect, the only reason I have this is Diablo Frank from the Rolled Spine Podcasting Network many years ago mailed me this enormous box of just stuff he found around his house. It was so heavy, actually, I threw out my back lifting this box.
That could go badly wrong. I hope you mean comic books.
Yes, that's a good point, okay. Especially when Diablo Frank's involved. That's a great point. But it was all comic book stuff, and I think these may have been in there, so I'm going to give him credit, even if I'm wrong. But yeah, like this particular one has, you know, like I said, has a Kid Eternity little article. It's got an article about Batman the Cult, the trade paperback. It's got an article about Detective Comics 627. Then it's got, as you said, all those solicitations. Then it's got a full-page sort of discussion and interview with Jim Aparo.
Wow.
Exactly. Especially from this late in the game, 1991. That's great.
Yeah.
So, and then the ad has the back cover is a reprint of the Kid Eternity cover from 1940. Anyway, Detroit Currents, where they were a lot of fun, and that's not really what we're here to talk about, but I couldn't resist. Us old timers enjoy this kind of stuff. Well, before we start breaking out Saturday Evening Post from the 1940s and start reminiscing, we should take a second to thank our sponsors. This episode of JSA in the 90s is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library. Usually, it's tied into this month's JSA issue in some way, shape, or form. The book I was looking for was not available, which is The Demise of Justice. So, I went with an old tried and true one that I absolutely adore. It's JLA, JSA, Virtue and Vice trade paperback. This is the 2023 edition. This is reprinting the amazing crossover between JLA and JSA. It's got art by Carlos Pacheco. It's written by David S. Goyer and Jeff Johns. It's a lot of fun. Great combination of the two teams, I believe over a Thanksgiving meal, if I remember correctly. Really a fun adventure. It's 96 pages. It was full color, soft cover. Normally is $14.99, but it's 40% off, so it's only $8.99. That's $9. That's less than like a fast food meal nowadays. So you can enjoy this 96-page JLA, JSA, Virtue and Vice trade paperback. That's my pick. What about yourself? Did you bring anything, Chris?
I did. I went for something showcasing this issue's JSA cover star. So may I present The Flash by Mark Waid, Omnibus Hardcover, Volume 1, written by legendary comic scribe Mark Waid and drawn by various artists. But let's particularly single out the incredible incredible work of the late, great Mike Wieringo. This hardcover has a cover drawn by one of your favorite artists, Shag, Ty Templeton, and it has Jay Garrick as one of the three Flashes on the cover. So Woo-hoo! The blurb says, experience Wally West inheriting the mantle of the fastest man alive in this volume, chronicling Mark Waid's critically acclaimed run. When a freak accident gives Wally the same super speed powers as his uncle Barry Allen, aka The Flash, Wally's journey towards becoming a true hero begins. Watch him take on terrorists, gunmen, and villains like the Devious Mirror Master in these supersonic stories. This omnibus collects The Flash issues 62 to 91, so that's basically 2.5 years worth of Flash issues, The Flash annuals 4 to 6, Green Lantern 30 and 31, which if memory serves is a team up between Hal Jordan and Wally to fight off a combination of Hector Hammond and Gorilla Grodd, and has a special guest appearance from Rex the Wonder Dog. Ooh. It is embarrassing that I did not have to look that up. The Flash special number 1 and Justice League quarterly number 10, which has a Wally West short story, which is one of my all-time favorite Flash stories, when Wally gets trapped in an elevator. Now, saying that out loud, I do realize that doesn't sound like the most exciting premise for a Flash story. But imagine there's danger, you're the fastest man alive, and you can barely move. It's a really clever use of Flash powers. So trust me, either buy the book or it's more exciting than you hear me say it. The page count on this is 1,088 pages. If you try to carry this anywhere, you will be the slowest man alive and possibly give yourself the biggest hernia alive. We are at the other end of the price spectrum. Just in case you've got Christmas money burning a hole in your pocket, this was 150 of your American dollars, but the in-stock trades price is $85.50. You say 43%. This is a modern classic run. If you haven't read this, you owe it to yourself to buy it.
Oh, this is the run that made me a lifelong Flash reader. Yeah, so I'd already read some of the Bill Mester Loeb stuff, but this was what absolutely sold me and made me fall in love with the series. The Born to Run, I think, is what it starts out with.
Yes.
Then you get, not too long after that, you get into the Return of Barry Allen. I mean, there is some amazing stuff in here, which is so incredibly good and so wonderful. You mentioned the Rex the Wonder Dog. I'll tell a super quick story. So I don't remember what issue it was, but yeah, Rex the Wonder Dog shows up, and it's like, that's the cliffhanger at the end of the issue, right? So that all these animals are running wild, and suddenly there's this white dog, and he says, my name is Rex, I'm here to help. And I'm over here, punch in the air. I'm so excited, because I know him from Who's Who, and because of Who's Who burned so brightly in my mind, and Rex had an entry, I thought everyone knew who Rex was. I thought Rex was a really big deal. Right, I'm going around telling everyone I know, like, Rex the Wonder Dog's back. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, no, you didn't hear me right. I said Rex the Wonder Dog, and nothing, just crickets. But for me, it was a great moment, so burns brightly in my mind as well, sir.
That is great. And that now crypto's got such prominence, we'd probably need a crypto and Rex the Wonder Dog team up in the movies, don't we?
That would be the best ever. Oh my gosh. They could both drink from the Fountain of Youth. There we go.
Yep.
There's a callback for some folks. Oh, wow. Well, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we need some help with the expenses. So we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. So if you're enjoying the JSA in the 90s podcast, the best way to support the show is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And at certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your show of choice, just like these folks who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. So our thanks go out to this all-star squadron of supporters. Alex Osias, Al the Comics Guy, Bill Beer, Bruno Diaz, Chris Mort, Craig Fletcher, David Ace Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, Ducky, Extremely Uncanny, George Van Note, Gord Tolton, Jason Keen, Jay Campbell, Keith G. Baker, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Matt Ev, Michael Bailey, Michael Crouch, Mike Atchison, Mike Zumkowski, so many Mikes, Roger Preeb, Little Russell Burbage, Symbol Pending, Ted Kilvington, and Tim Price. Again, folks, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. All right, folks, and remember, as I always say, go out on the social medias, find us as JSA Presents, because it's all about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. And most importantly, leave your comments on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com/JSA, because we want to hear from you, and we'll read your feedback at the end of the episode. Now, this is the part of the show where I get to chat with our guest. And Chris, I want to ask you, what is your personal origin story with the JSA? How'd you discover the team? What made you fall in love with them?
So I've kind of mentioned my comics origin story on various shows on the network before, but the long story short is that American comics were not easy for me to get hold of with any sort of regularity in the UK until I went to university. And there was a dedicated comic book store on Duke Street in Cardiff called Forbidden Planet, which was a chain of comic book stores over here.
No, wait a minute. Hold on. I'm sorry. Cardiff? You were in Cardiff?
Yes, Jack. That's where I did my training, was in Cardiff. Which,
oh my gosh,
was not the media hub that it is now. It's I go back there occasionally and go, all of this has changed since I was here 30 years ago. But yeah, it wasn't the Doctor Who creation machine that it is now. But there, wow, we go. Yeah, so
That, folks. Chris and I are both huge Doctor Who fans, so I just
I can show you around the bad streets of Cardiff if you want. So I was always a Green Lantern guy, so that was the first book I started buying. But you know, looking along the shelves, I did look at other titles, and at this point, Shag, I feel I have to draw back the curtain and enter the Bwahaha confessional. Forgive me, Shag, it's been forever since my last confession, because at this point I have to tell you that the next title I picked up and rejected was Justice League America. It was the General Glory storyline, and there was this weird ginger-haired Green Lantern on the cover, and it was Linda Medley art. And I now appreciate what an incredible cartoonist she was, but at the time the art style wasn't quite what I expected or quite what I wanted. And so I moved along the shelf and picked up this JSA miniseries, and the art was much more to what I was expecting. And I was intrigued by this Flash who wasn't Barry Allen. I think it was the Mercury helmet that did it for me, to be honest with you. So at a time when my whole comic collection amounted to about 4 or 5 issues of Green Lantern, JSA was the first comics miniseries I ever bought. It was the first team book I ever read. It was the first Flash comic I ever bought. And a lot of my subsequent comic reading over many years sort of stemmed from here, really. So I didn't know what the difference between the JSA and the JLA was. I didn't know why this Flash and Green Lantern were different to the ones I knew from the Super Friends cartoon and the previous comics I read. But I really loved it. I loved the retro feel of it. I bought it all. I enjoyed it. And that led to Armageddon 2001, and then the follow-up series Armageddon Inferno, which you've discussed before, and the JSA get released from limbo, and then that went into the 10 issues you've just discussed, and then into the Golden Age, and then into the 1999 David S. Goyer, James Robinson team, which pivots into Geoff Johns. And look, when I follow a series, I tend to go all in. I am a mark for the DC marketing department. So there were other series like the Our Man series with Rag Morales and the JSA Confidential. So it just kind of blossomed from there, along with a whole load of other titles that I started picking up.
That Our Man book is so good and so underrated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Those are really good issues, really good story. And also keeps dipping into bits of DC legacy as well, doesn't it? So, yeah, wonderful stuff. And I just love the JSA. I think, you know, they've got that Greatest Generation morality and decency. And then you later get that sense of legacy that Goyer, Robinson and Johns, you know, really push. And you do get those qualities in other team books to a greater or lesser extent. But in the JSA, these are front and center. They're the ethos of the book. It's what drives the characters to act in the way that they do. And I was thinking, you know, Superman sometimes gets a bit of a bad rap for being the big blue Boy Scout. But between Superman and the decency and morality of the JSA, you've got a real purity of principle. And it's a template for all the other heroes in the DCU, really. So I think that, you know, the whole DCU owes a lot to the JSA. Yeah, love reading them. Different feel to other teams, but it underpins the whole thing.
Well, I love that we've got you on this issue then. I mean, that was totally a happy accident that I asked you to be on issue number one, but it being your first miniseries you ever bought, that's incredible.
Yeah.
So excited to have you here.
You know, when you start a new hobby and you're just in that honeymoon period, mm-hmm. you know, you're just that. I was absorbing so much information about the DCU at this point. You know, so excited to learn more because I had this, what I thought I knew, you know, the sort of Batman and Robin, Superman, Wonder Woman. I mostly knew about those from other media. And I knew a little bit about Super Friends cartoon. And I bought the odd comic here and there. But I suddenly realized all I thought I knew was just a microscopic bit of the universe. And this broadened my horizons out to kind of see everything that was going on. So yeah, I was just absorbing it all like a sponge.
Until listening to you, I didn't really think about the fact that this was the first JSA series I bought that was contemporary. Because when I became a JSA fan, it was all out of the back issue bins. It was the 1970s revival in All-Star Comics. It was the All-Star Squadron. It was the Young All-Stars. All those books that I purchased came out of the bins. None of them were being picked up off the new comic shelf. So this would have been the first time I picked a new JSA book off the shelf. I didn't even think about that. Huh. Wow.
Yeah.
So, it's a fun series too. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with it.
It is. It is.
Now, there is an interesting history with this comic series. This comic series wasn't supposed to happen. Isn't that right?
That's right. So we both had this memory while we were talking about it. We both sort of both came up with this vague recollection. And I don't think either of us really knew where it came from, that this miniseries came because there was a delay, a glitch in DC licensing a whole load of properties to form a brand new line of comics called the Impact Line. The Impact Line, capital I is not a capital I, it's an exclamation point. So there's even more exclamation points than in that, in that house ad. The Impact Line was designed to be an imprint to appeal to younger readers, and they licensed some old superheroes from the Archie Comics Red Circle line. So they launched with titles called The Black Hood, The Jaguar, The Comet, The Fly, which is different to the human fly, Max, and The Web, and then sometime later by the Crusaders. And we both kind of remembered that somehow or other, this 8-issue miniseries was somehow tied in with the delayed launch of Impact. And it turns out that they were basically had these artists and writers on presumably some sort of temporary contract, and they needed to give them work to be doing whilst all the administrative stuff and the bureaucratic stuff went through. So the result, gloriously for us, is this 8-issue miniseries featuring the Justice Society.
And how lucky are we that there was this delay in the contract? And surprisingly, it must have been an 8-month delay, or maybe there was a delay and they decided to pad a couple extra months to give them more time to be ready for the launch. I'm not sure. But 8 months of delay enough that Mike Gold and Brian Augustine came up with this idea to set the JSA story in the 50s, but mainly not to step on Roy Thomas's All-Star Squadron series. They were very careful to dance around all that. And by the way, a lot of this research, I'll cite a couple sources where we're doing, like Martin Gray. I don't know if you know who that guy is.
I've heard his name around, yeah.
Over on his Too Dangerous for a Girl blog, he published some information on that I borrowed from. Benjamin Herman has a great website as well that has stuff on there. And History of Impact Comics has some stuff. But we pulled this from a number of different locations. However, while those are mainly fan speculations, you actually found a more specific source. Isn't that right?
Yes, the miniseries has a letter column, but obviously they don't have any letters for the first couple of issues. So they filled it with a secret origin of a miniseries. Now, the issue we're talking about, issue one, has a very helpful to a new reader potted history of the Justice Society. But part two, which will be in next month's issue, sorry, I'm stepping on somebody's toes, actually has all the kind of the logistics of pulling together the deal with Archie Comics and trying to get it on going. They don't talk a lot about it. They use phrases like the undisclosed big deal, all capitalized. But with a bit of imagination, you can see that it's basically they're talking about pulling the Impact Line together. And basically, yeah, they said, look, we had creators who had mouths to feed and mortgages to pay, and we needed to come up with something. And so Brian Augustine and Mike Gold went away, and both, apparently, it says here, came up with the same idea of doing a JSA series. So that is the book we are holding in our hands right now.
So the Impact line is interesting, right? Because again, like you said, they licensed the Red Circle stuff from Archie.
Yeah.
And at the time, all the publishers were looking for new ways to make money, obviously. And Valiant Comics had come along. They were a year or two old at this point. And Valiant Comics was really growing. They had built a shared universe like a Marvel or a DC. And so different publishers were looking at that going, wait a minute, we can do that too. So DC was, looking at the timeline here, this is, if I remember right, this is, late 1990, this would have been even before Image Comics happened, really. So they're pretty forward thinking with trying to create a new little, shared universe. So they go after this. Of course, Image Comics will be the next big one. Ultraverse. There's going to be a lot of these various, pocket universes, or if you want to call them, out there. And so I didn't realize until just now that, this is ahead of Image. So interesting for DC was thinking that way.
As a newbie reader, I was totally hooked in by the house ads for this. You're in on the ground floor of a new universe spiel. There's a sucker born every minute. And listener, I was that sucker. I bought the Comet and the Crusaders. My mate, who was buying comics at the time, bought the Fly, so we would trade. So how about you, Shag? Did Impact books make an impact on your buying?
Absolutely. I loved it. I bought pretty much all the books, like number one. And by the way, in that list you rattled off, I remembered Legend of S.H.I.E.L.D. was another one.
So
I dabbled in all of them, but I ended up, I had to go back and look at my collection, my listing, and the Fly, the Comet, and the Jaguar are the three I really stuck with. And I remember being specifically struck by the Jaguar, and I think it was kind of my favorite story, actually, even though the Fly is Mike Parabek art, the Comet is Tom Lyle art. I mean, just unbelievable artists here,
they
right?
They had such good creators on these books.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I had already knew Tom Lyle from Starman, so loved his work. And Parabek, I guess I didn't know. I guess I knew Parabek maybe from this series, but either way, was totally wowed by those. But the Jaguar story just really grabbed me. And looking through my list, I forgot that I actually got Mark Waid to sign Comet number 2, which I had to look in Mike's Amazing World. This is one of his earliest writing or scripter credits at all. And I remember he was so nice. He was nobody at this point. And he was so nice and he was so kind and we just chatted. And I remember at one point, I got him to sign some other book at the same time that he was the editor on. And I remember him teasing me mercilessly saying, no one asks the editor to sign a book. And so it was just really nice to meet him so early in his career.
It didn't last long, Impact Comics. I think it had about 18 months in it. And I do remember saying to Shag that the Comet has some really good twists. They obviously have got to the point where they go, we have nothing to lose, so we are going to make this end a roller coaster ride. I still think of the end of the Comet, the last sort of 3-4 issues of the Comet, as a really good way to go out. But I remember a text piece at the back of the sort of the last issue of the Comet where they presented Mark Waid with the gig and says, our main character has the powers of a living comet. And him thinking, what on earth does that mean? A comet doesn't live and it doesn't have powers. So he just basically had complete free rein to do what he wanted to do. But I think the Comet is such a good set. The Fly was a bit Spider-Man-y. It was fantastic, glorious Mike Parabek art. I mean, just gorgeous. I think it was quite light. I don't think it dealt with a whole lot of heavy stuff, but it was a fun. But I think the Impact line is sorely maligned, and I'm sad it's not more fondly remembered, because I had such a good time. It was a good set of books to start reading when you were a new reader.
So I remember reading them. Now, by the time I started working at a comic shop, it was already 6 months into the run. By that point, the shine had come off quite a bit already. I mean, they really, like you said, they died early. And it's sort of sad to watch that. I was there for the petering out, right? And I can't remember if these were available on newsstands. I would hope they were. I mean, that would be certainly the ideal target market, right? If you're trying to get them in the hands of kids.
I would think, yeah.
I don't know if by the end if they were, though. I don't know if DC was bothering to distribute. I just don't remember. But anyway, it's sad to watch a lot of these new universes burn brightly and then fade quickly.
Yeah.
Ultraverse, is one of my absolute favorites. But folks, why don't you tell us at home? Tell us in the comments, did you enjoy the Impact line? Did you read them? What were your favorite books? And then go ahead and put your obligatory comments in there about the Who's Who podcast. When are we ever going to cover Who's Who and Impact? Sure, go ahead and ask. You can ask as many times as you'd like. And I will tell you the same answer I always tell everyone, Rob Kelly and I, my partner, have known for years how we're going to cover the Who's Who and Impact, and it will happen. The question is when. So there we go.
Judgment Day or Who's Who in the Impact Universe, which will come first?
There, yeah, good question.
But hey, it merited, was it three issues of Who's Who? I think I'm saying off the top of my head. There was more than two, I think, weren't there? But it merited that level of commitment from the company to do it.
I can't remember whether it was two or three. I think you're right. I think it was three, but they even got their own binder. So, hey, that's a...
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you get Brian Bolland binder for Who's Who, George Perez binder for Who's Who, and Impact binder. So, I mean, that says a lot.
It does. It does.
All right. Well, why don't we get into this issue, which is what we're supposed to be talking about 30 minutes into the show. folks, you can go over to our website, which again, fireandwaterpodcast.com. I'll have an image gallery there. I'll include some of the images here. Not a lot, though, because I mean, the fact is you can find the floppies on this thing. You can read it on DC Infinite. You can even, if you have DC Ultra Humanite on DC Infinite, you can read the Demise of Justice trade paperback where this is collected, which I also looked at for this. So there's lots of places you can read this. So please be sure to look at that. But again, I'll throw a few pages on the gallery, including that ad I mentioned to you. And I'll put DC Currents out there as well. All right, so this is the very first comic ever called Justice Society of America, number one. Published by DC Comics, cover dates April 1991, on the shelves February 19th, 1991. Cover price is $1, four shiny quarters. Cover is by Tom Lyle. Yes! Why don't you describe the cover for us?
Fantastic. So, as Shag said, this is the cover to Justice Society of America. Now, knowing now that this is the first book to be called Justice Society of America, the logo does take up quite a bit of space. But hey, if it's your first outing, I can forgive that. It looks period appropriate. It's got a good, strong retro vibe. And it gets reused for the 10-issue series that you've just covered, Shag. Mm-hmm. So, very helpfully, the cover says at the top, part one of eight. I like that it tells you A, how where you are in the story, and B, how long the miniseries is going to be. That's good information. And to appeal to those of us of a certain vintage, there is a corner box illustration. The heads of the five heroes we will see in this series. So at the top, we've got the Golden Age Flash, and then we've got Black Canary and Golden Age Hawkman. So that's the yellow cowl with a red hawk across the forehead. And then at the bottom, Golden Age Green Lantern and Fin-Headed Starman. And they're small heads, but they're well rendered. And it's just one of those details that brings waves of nostalgia to readers of a certain age. The main image we've got is a very dynamic one. It's of Golden Age Flash Jay Garrick running directly at us with his helmet set at an angle that can only be described as jaunty. And we know that we're at Boulder Dam Generating Station, partly thanks to a little sign in the bottom left corner. And then there's all the electricity cables and a big old dam in the background. Jay is running away from a probably 30 to 40 foot high living constellation. He's glowing, perhaps from stellar energy or perhaps from high voltage power that he's drawing off the power lines. And his other hand holds a heavy cudgel studded with big spikes, which I feel is a weapon that the Silver Age Hawkman would love quite a lot. And somehow, perhaps because it's also made out of stellar energy, it's firing out energy blasts that Jay is having to dodge. And we should also note that the giant is making quite a bold set of fashion statements. He's bare-chested, his wild hair and beard are making a lion's mane of hair around his face. But the only clothing he's wearing is a big high-waisted belt and, daringly, a very mini, above-the-mid-thigh miniskirt. One strong blast of solar wind, and we're all going to be exposed to a Marilyn Monroe seven-year itch wardrobe malfunction. But fortunately, in the 1990s, we still have Comic Code Authority approval, so we readers of a delicate disposition are spared the worst.
I hadn't quite thought of it that way, but you're not wrong. You're not wrong. I love this comic. I love this cover. And I'm touching on different things you mentioned. The logo, for example. Yes, this is absolutely the first time we've seen this logo. It is my absolute favorite JSA logo of all time. Folks, if you look on your phone that you're listening to right now, you'll see the Justice Society Presents show logo for the podcast you're listening to. This is where I took the logo from. right here, this series. I absolutely love that style. Now, for the 10-issue Mike Parabek series, they do remove the box that's behind it. There's like a red box here on the cover, but I feel like the box gives it that sort of Silver Age look, which really helps it stand out. I just adore it. Now, you mentioned the corner box. I don't have much more to say beyond it other than it's glorious. And I am also of that certain age that it just brings pure joy to see those heads. This is about the I think this is a little bit ahead because DC will play around with corner boxes in 92. I don't know that they were playing around with corner boxes in 91. So this may be a little bit, again, ahead of its time a bit for DC to do that. But it's just beautifully rendered. And it's got to be Tom Lyle because he did all these covers. It looks great. Jay Garrick absolutely looks fantastic. There's a lot of dynamic motion. Orion the Hunter, by the way, is who this constellation we're all pretty sure is. I did a little research on various constellations, and I always think of Orion with a bow and arrow, but reading about it, they actually talk about him carrying a club quite a bit. So that would be this. But, you know, he's moving, he's blasting, Jay's running, but it's done so well and laid out so cleverly by Tom Lyle that Jay is running directly square into the middle of the cover. So you can't help but miss that he is the main focus. And really, it's down to the fact that Tom Lyle is just so damn good. Good as an artist. And what a heartbreak. Another talent gone too soon. Yeah. Tom Lyle was an amazing designer, amazing illustrator, a lot of energy, a lot of fun creativity. And I mentioned, by the way, Jay, I love the squinty eyes. The squinty eyes always says golden age, right? So that's fantastic. And I don't have much more other than to just ooze joy looking at this cover.
Yeah. The cover is really the first thing that grabs you, isn't it, on the shelf. And this is bright. It's colorful. I love looking at how, I'm not an artist, but I love looking at how your eye gets drawn through a cover. And so you hit the big, bold JSA logo, and then you're drawn down through the giant and the blast, and then you hit the zoom lines coming off Jay. It just flows really nicely. And like I say, I don't know art, but I can't draw for toffee. But I love looking at how beautifully it's designed and how cleverly it's designed, so that the thing that really pops out of you is Jay running right at you out of the cover. Great stuff.
And you can look at it two different ways. Like you said, the coloring makes Jay the focus. And alternatively, I've always been told people read images in a Z formation. They start in the top left corner, go to the top right, go to the bottom left, then go bottom right. And if you read in that same Z formation, exactly, you go across the logo, you go across the constellation, and you end on Jay. So either way you read it, it works well. And I didn't think about this till just now, but really, the JSA, for the most part, had been on ice since 86, right? From publishing, you get the last days of the JSA. The JSA goes away. I mean, sure, they're kind of remembered through Infinity Inc. and Young All-Stars, but not all that much. And those were gone a couple years before this anyway. So this was sort of a triumphant return of this team. So a lot of fun. So let's get inside. Why don't we?
Let's do it.
Writer is Len Strazewski. Sounds familiar. He wrote that 10-issue series by Parabek. So artist is Rick Burchett. That means pencils and inks, both by Rick Burchett. Letter is Janice Chang. Colorist is Tom Zucchio. Editors are Brian Augustine and Mike Gold. And the title of the miniseries itself is Vengeance from the Stars. And it says Chapter 1. This particular installment's called Beware the Savage Skies. You want to start us off?
Sure. So as you say, I'll give the title of this episode with my own emphasis. Beware the Savage Skies. Bit of a clue there, folks. Wink, wink. The year is 1950. The otherwise respectful grand opening of the Mount Pride Observatory is disrupted by the appearance of a strange, white-haired, hippie-esque figure brandishing a sign which reads, "End is near." Interrupting the opening speeches, the old-timer seems compelled to warn the world that total destruction is close at hand, wildly warning everyone to beware the savage skies. Security try to have the man removed, but observatory director Ted Knight graciously allows the man to say his piece. And for this courtesy, the protester thrusts a rolled-up parchment into Dr. Knight's hand before fleeing the scene. Later that night, Ted sneaks into his own observatory to use the main telescope to investigate the old man's star chart before he has to get down to some actual, you know, science and that. To Ted's amazement, he turns the telescope onto an unusual formation of stars, which then coalesce into the form of a woman dancing through the sky before turning her malevolent gaze directly down the barrel of Ted's telescope. The lenses of the telescope shatter. Ted lets out a terrible cry and fades to black. 1 week later, the fastest man alive, Jay Garrick, speeds up to the observatory. The previously pristine building is closed for repairs, with the observatory dome badly cracked. It's so seriously damaged, Jay wonders if an earthquake had hit the place. Inside, Ted Knight had barely put down the phone receiver from calling his GSA teammate. Ted reveals that the something he'd seen in space is responsible not only for the damage to the observatory, but also destroying electrical power stations and siphoning off the power across the country, a truth that the government was keeping from the citizens in order to prevent panic. But Ted knows the full facts. An energy being from the stars is the cause, and he reveals to Jay that it wasn't only the observatory that was mangled. Ted glides forward to reveal that he's been put into a wheelchair by the attack. Sorry, old friend, I think I'm out of the mystery man business forever. Ted suggests that Jay heads to Boulder Dam Generating Plant as a likely location where the energy beast might strike next, and Jay zooms off, vowing to avenge his teammate. Watching his friend leave, Ted apologizes, but a mysterious figure lurking in the shadows congratulates Knight for sending the Flash to his doom. When Ted tries to argue, he's slapped back by the albino hand of another villain. There's another bit of a hint there too. Abused and beaten, both physically and mentally, Ted is a broken man and acknowledges the hidden villain as his master. Jay arrives at Boulder Dam and speaks with the manager. Their generators are already at full capacity, trying to make up the shortfall from the plants that are already offline. Jay tells the foreman that the dam may be the next target when suddenly there's a surge in the generators before the power goes dead and a huge giant made up of electrical and stellar energy forms in front of the dam. It swipes viciously through the transmission cables, drinking in the raw electricity. Jay speeds into action using all the usual speedster tricks to defeat the giant. Tornadoes, super speed, dodging, etc. In fact, he gets a bit cocky and is knocked out of his complacency when he narrowly dodges a blast from the giant's great cudgel. Jay admits that his foe is pretty quick for a big lummox. Whilst he feels he's getting the upper hand, Jay admits that he has no idea how to definitively beat this energy giant.
And you know it's serious because Jay's helmet gets knocked off. So
yeah, that's bad.
Sorry, I'll take it from here. So the Flash is darting across the Boulder Dam at near light speed, dodging blast after blast from the constellation creature. It's weakening, but not fast enough. So it calls out to the dam workers for ideas. With their help, he weaves giant metal cables through the girders, creating an enormous conductive net meant to ground the creature and drain off its energy.
It's technically called a Faraday cage, Shag.
Thanks for that. Be careful, your nerd is showing.
Now my knowledge is showing, but I'll take the nerd badge.
All right, so for the moment, the Faraday cage works, and the creature begins to shrink. But then it morphs into a massive canine-shaped beast. It snaps the cable net with its jaws and starts growing even larger. With no clear way to stop it, the Flash shifts his focus to saving the workers caught in the chaos. Desperate, he plans to shove the creature off the dam into the river, hoping the water will discharge its stored power. But before he can finish evacuating the area, the energy hound hurls a metal girder straight into him. With a giant sprang, the Flash goes down hard, unconscious, while the creature continues tearing through the dam. Meanwhile, we check in with the shadowy Big Bad. So we see Ted Knight, and there with him is Solomon Grundy, who's also working for this mysterious bad guy, and they're being dispatched to the next phase of their plan. And by the end of the issue, the damage is catastrophic. Boulder Dam's collapse of systems triggers a nationwide power failure, plunging millions into the darkness. To be continued next issue, Black Canary. So there we go. All right, so now we're getting into it. What do you think of this one, buddy?
Okay, this is a really good opening issue. It's really solid. There's a lot to set up. We haven't seen the JSA for many, many years, so there's a lot of things we've got to set up here. But it's perhaps just worth starting by mentioning the overall structure to this 8-issue miniseries. The first 4 issues are individual hero stories, and then the next 2 issues, they pair up into 2s, and then there's a 2-part finale where everybody comes together. So that's 8 issues in total.
Which is interesting because they actually got a lot of letters complaining about that format. Like, a lot of readers were not happy. They were just getting one hero per issue. They were saying, you know, this is supposed to be the Justice Society of America. Why aren't I getting the full JSA? And either they didn't realize that it was going to slowly build to a team, or maybe they had just forgotten the structure of the original JSA stories. I think it works well, especially if you read it in, like, you know, one go. But But I enjoy that setup. But yeah, there were a lot of unhappy fans at the start.
I'm with you, Shag. I think it's great to have them all doing their individual bits because, hey, that's how it all started, wasn't it? You know, the very first JSA comic was basically a framing device for individual stories. So I have no problem with this. And again, as a new reader, this was an introduction to lots of new characters, you know, getting their own time in the spotlight, really. So I'm very happy with it. I thought it was great.
Straczynski will follow this formula with the series we just covered, too, where he introduces pretty much two heroes per issue and doles them out slowly, building to a giant team setting.
Yeah. So I have no problem with it. But yeah, so in the coming months, expect a few individual stories before we get to the team starting to come together. I thought it was really clear storytelling. You know, the time is really set out right at the front. And as you quite rightly say, you know, they picked 1950, partly because the team disbands in 1951 and partly because they already had this previous continuity that they didn't want to disrupt. And there's some nice period bits. The gentlemen are all in nice suits. They do some cutaways to various bits of 1950s pop culture. We see Vandal Savage watching and not really enjoying some 1950s TV, some sitcoms and some news broadcasts and things like that. And yeah, I mean, to the point that he hates it so much, he blows up the television with Starman's cosmic rod. So,
which is interesting. He hates TV so much, and yet he clearly has multiple televisions because, as you said, he blows up one TV, and then the next time we see him, you see the destroyed TV, and next to it is another TV. So I guess he just buys them and just so he can destroy them. He's very careless with his money. I guess when you're eternal, you're careless with your money.
Yeah. And then we get the energy drain. And I think that's established well as a sort of, you know, bigger threat. And actually that theme will run through certainly the next few issues that we see. So I think it had to be an establishing issue. And I think it did that really competently, very efficiently. You know where you are with this story.
Absolutely. And I want to touch on what you said about the art and, like, you know, how the guys look in suits and all that. I mean, that's down to Rick Burchett. I mean, what a great choice to start this series off. He's got a very slick style. I love seeing him here as a penciler and an inker. At this point in his career, he was more doing inking. He hadn't done a ton of pencils to this point, but he's got a really classic style. And the characters, to me, they look like you would imagine a 1950s character being illustrated. Now, I'm not saying they look like a 1950s comic book art, but just they look like people from the 50s, and there's a certain style. I don't know how to say it other than retro. And when you see the panels, you'll know what I'm talking about. You'll get it. You're like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And it is sad. Now, he's fantastic. But if you look at the rest of the artists that we're going to get, and even some of the people who worked in this issue, you know, we mentioned Brian Augustine and Tom Lyle both worked in this issue. Sadly, they're no longer with us. Mm-hmm. Later issues, Mike Parabek, Tom Artis, Frank McLaughlin, all these are folks that worked in the series, and they're not with us anymore. So very sad to not have those folks with us anymore. And we'll talk more about them as we go along. I guess I should get back to Rick Burchett here. I do want to provide a little bit of context on him. I looked him up and just to find out some of his history. Of course, I know his work, but his earliest work was at publishers such as First Comics, Pacific Comics, AC Comics, and others. And his first work for DC wasn't too terribly long before this, at least as a penciler, was on the Black Hawk Stories in Action Comics Weekly. And he worked on, he's probably best known, at least of our generation, he's best known for working on several iterations of the comic adaptations of Batman the Animated Series. He started off as the inker on the very first issue, and he received Eisner's for, the series changed. Of course, it was called Batman Adventures, and then it was, you know, Batman and Robin, and blah, the name changed a lot. But either way, he received two Eisner's for working on that book with Paul Dini and Ty Templeton, which is absolutely amazing. And I didn't know this, except I was doing my research. A little interesting nugget is that back in 1985, Rick Burchett and another artist met a young aspiring artist in St. Louis, and they convinced him that his portfolio was so good that he needed to go meet other comic editors. So this young artist went to New York Comic Con and met Archie Goodwin. So Jim Lee was partially inspired.
Who he?
Right. Jim Lee. Who is that guy? Rick Burchett played a role in helping Jim Lee to help get his career off the ground, which is crazy.
And his impact assignment was the Black Hood. So that not a book I read, I have to say, but I would imagine if it looked anything like this, it was, I don't know how easy it is to go back and find those old issues, but that would be quite the read, I think.
That was the more darker of the books, as I recall. He was the dark, edgier sort of, not quite a Batman sort of character, but definitely the darker, edgier vigilante.
Slightly anti-hero-y, yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I think, you know, we talk on JLA about Kevin Maguire and his acting. I think Rick Burchett's faces are really good. I think when you look at, you know, Ted Knight going from talking to Jay to being, you know, broken, the facial expressions that Jay has during the fight, terrific, really good acting, I think.
Absolutely phenomenal. And since we're talking about this, I just want to mention there's like Burchett is such a craftsman, like from his page. You mentioned the faces, but also his panel layouts. Like if you just look at like page 8 is a good example where you got all these varying shapes and borders and the storytelling is, oh, it was a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 panels on this page. The storytelling is immaculate. You know exactly what's going on. And there's even like a nice little cutout of Jay's head in the last panel, which Jay just looks like a total boss. And I just really fantastic artwork and design and eye. It's really great. And because again, when I think Rick Burchett, I'm thinking more Paul Dini style. I'm not thinking traditional comic style. And yet he was a great illustrator.
Yeah. I mean, yes, you're right. That sort of, it's not that silhouette of Jay's head, but it's just the head down to the neck, isn't it? And I always think of that sort of image where it's just that isolated face shot as being quite Silver Agey. So yeah, really fits with the old timey feel of this book, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great. So yeah, again, new comic reader, hadn't really known very much about Ted Knight or Starman at all. In fact, nothing at all. So I think it's quite a good introduction to Ted. The only really Starman-y thing we see him do is use his gravity rod to break into the observatory, because he's taken off the table quite quickly by the arrival of the living constellation. But he feels like a well-rounded character. You know, you get the sense of shock really when you see him wheel himself out in a wheelchair and how unexpected that is. They do a really good job, as opposed to the not quite so good job they do of hiding the villains. Actually, the reveal of Ted in a wheelchair is really quite startling. So I think he's good.
So I got a question about that. So I do wonder, how did Vandal Savage break Ted Knight? You know, obviously something happens with the constellation coming through the telescope. I hope that's explained later. I mean, I have read this miniseries a few times, but it's been a couple of years, so I don't remember specifically. I assume they're going to explain how and Andromeda, which by the way is that living constellation we saw, how she injures him. But how did he emotionally break Ted? Because Ted even mouths off and gets slapped for it. But
yeah,
it's very sad to see him. Now it does sort of tie in also if you flash forward in James Robinson's Starman series, he established that Ted had a nervous breakdown, and they tie that to the working on the bomb, you know, in the 40s or 50s. And there's sort of a thread there where you could say that maybe this is part of that story. You know, something happened here. Now he will come out of this, and he does come out of the wheelchair by the end of the story, if I remember correctly. But so it sort of kind of maybe fits in with Ted's breakdown, maybe.
Yeah. Yes. Spoiler: Ted is not permanently disabled. I think that from memory, and again, I haven't read as far forward for a long time, but I think the sort of redemption arc of Ted Knight in this is part of the broader story. So he certainly becomes one of the heroes we see at the end of the run of this. But yeah, I can't remember quite what's happened. But yes, I mean, he's obviously, you know, doing okay, but he's in that he's the director of this observatory. But it's not kind of saying he's doing lots of active superheroics at this stage. So maybe that's part of the, you know, rehabilitation after being part of the Manhattan Project.
It could be. And I want to mention the observatory real quick too. So Mount Pride Observatory, it's in New Mexico. They established that here. And an episode or two ago, my guest Tim Price, he and I were talking about why they put Mount Pride in New Mexico. I thought that was kind of a strange suggestion, especially, you know, Opal City hadn't been created yet, but I had always assumed Ted Knight was, you know, an East Coast superhero like most of them. But Tim had a great suggestion, was that maybe they put the Mount Pride Observatory retroactively in New Mexico to try and tie in with the Will Payton Starman, who was living in the American Southwest. Now, I did a little more research since then. I completely forgot. Lynn Strzuski, not only did he write this miniseries, was writing the Starman book at this time. He had just started writing it in fall 1990. They had just done, shortly before this, a crossover with David Knight. David Knight had shown up in the Will Payton series. Now, I reviewed it. There's no mention of anything about the Knight family being in the Southwest, but The idea being that maybe they put Mount Pride in New Mexico again to sort of give a little bit of a connection to Will Payton. And in my research, I found out that the Mount Pride Observatory actually gets mentioned in an episode of the Supergirl TV series, of all places.
Oh, okay.
Crazy.
Deep cut.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, okay. So I wondered, I think the concept of a living constellation is pretty innovative. I can't remember too many of those. And I wondered if it sprung out of DC editorial saying Starman is going to be one of your five, or whether it was something that Len Strawinski had, you know, somewhere in the back of his brain from somewhere else. But I thought it was a really good, you know, good, interesting concept. Like you say, they're not very good at identifying the constellations. In fact, you have to go back to that Direct Currents promo thing to say that they, you know, where they name the constellations. So we think the miniskirt wearing giant is Orion, and we think the dancing lady that broke the telescope is Andromeda, but they don't actually say that. So I think that could have been slightly better clarified.
I agree completely. But we got to talk about the layout on page five, though. When we see Andromeda, it's an all white page, and it's just four overlapping circles, which are supposed to be the view through a telescope as she's beginning to coalesce, and then she's smiling right at you, and then she cracks the lens. Just what a fantastic layout, that page.
Yes. Yeah. It would be a stunning sequence if it was done as a bit of CGI, but to convey that in four static images, I think is just such excellent storytelling. Mm-hmm. You know precisely what's going on. It's really clear and, you know, beautifully laid out. Yeah. Really good storytelling.
Yeah.
I suppose we should talk about Jay as well as the main hero of this story, this episode. He's well portrayed. He's clearly a very good guy. Really good showcase for that sort of moral, heroic nature that we discussed earlier. But what I really like is, having seen a lot of Jay as quite a mature hero, it's quite nice to see him being a bit cocky and throwing out some puns during the fight. And making some youthful mistakes and not being completely certain how he's going to wrap this one up. I like that because we see him as the elder statesman, but he's not the elder statesman here. He's still learning his trade.
And he's at the peak of his power. I mean, there's a great scene. The first page we see Flash, which is one of my favorite pages. I love this. You know, Ted Knight has called him, and Ted Knight is hanging up the phone with Jay, and Jay is already running into the observatory. So basically, he says, I'll be right there, and he got there immediately. So that means he ran from Keystone City, which I believe is supposed to be Midwest, to New Mexico before Ted could even hang up the phone, which is great to think. And then later, Jay talks about running at near light speed. So, you know, when we always see Jay nowadays as the elder statesman, he's the slower of the Flashes. So I love seeing him being so fast.
Not so many people tapping into the Speed Force in 1950, clearly.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the timeline is slightly odd because that page does say 1 week later, and you see Jay zooming up to the observatory. I went, 1 week later? What, did you catch the bus? You know, it makes him look slower, but you need a little bit of time because you have to get from the destructive power of Andromeda coming down the telescope in some way, shape or form, and then to Ted being in a wheelchair and being subjugated by Vandal Savage. So there's a little bit of weirdness about the timeline because it does initially make Flash look a little bit slow on the uptake, but then you have to have the scene where Ted is just putting down the telephone receiver to go, no, he's still as fast as you think he is. So a little bit of timey-wimey stuff there.
I guess I viewed it differently, knowing that Ted is being controlled by, you know, again, spoiler, Vandal Savage here. In fact, being the Flash showing up at all was Vandal Savage's idea. Yeah. So I think Ted, you know, was beaten. He wasn't allowed to contact anyone. And so at this point is when they, you know, Vandal wants Flash into the mix. And so that's why it was a week later. And I guess, you know, maybe Keystone City wasn't reporting on what happens in New Mexico. So he wasn't hearing about what was happening.
Could be. I like that. I mean, the super speed stuff here is fairly routine. It's sort of tornadoes and a lot of running around, a lot of dodging. But for me, this was my first Flash comic. So I'm perfectly happy that we saw, you know, the sort of standard speed tricks that we see in other comics. You know, I thought the actual battle was quite well portrayed. Like I said, it's quite nice to see Jay zooming around and trying to just sort of dodge this giant and having to think of clever ways to defeat him.
You mentioned the puns. I genuinely laughed out loud at one of the puns where, you know, the constellation of Orion is he's manhandling these girders. He's absorbing all this electricity. And one of the workers says, he's eating it like candy. And Flash says, then I guess I better pull his sweet tooth. I actually laughed out loud at that line. I just thought it was hysterically funny. Did they talk like that in 1950 in comics? Probably not. But who cares? You know, this is a retroactive visionary version of it. Sort of like All-Star Squadron. 1940s comics weren't written in that way either. So you just accept the retcon, if you will. Yeah. But a lot of fun. You mentioned they were sort of stock standard Flash moves, but they work so well. And the comic, surprisingly, this battle goes on for a while. Like, you read it, then you get an interlude back with Ted, and then you're back to the battle. You're like, oh, this is still going. I thought this was wrapping up. So it makes for, obviously, a big challenge for Jay.
Yeah, and he's doing a lot of dodging around, but I quite like that he goes, I don't really know how to end this. You know, I think I'm just about getting the upper hand. And he uses the cables and the expertise of the power station workers around him to try and come up with a plan. Like I say, he's sort of thinking on his feet, isn't he? You can see him thinking it through. And I like that. I like it when you get a sort of slightly logical kind of plan. All of which is then undone when the giant turns into this sort of great big dog with an enormous spiked collar and sort of changes the game on Jay.
The dog was a bit of a weird thing for me. Like,
yeah,
that one throws me. The spike collar, which is very 1980s, you know, is sort of also is a little bit unusual. Now, yeah. I didn't do any research on that. Maybe there's a famous dog constellation that I'm not thinking of. But that one I thought was a little odd that I still, and again, I can go do some research, but nothing's coming to mind.
No, I mean, it was, I thought Cerberus, but Cerberus has many heads, doesn't it? So yes, it can't be that. This is, yeah, but... It's just a big old dog that can electrocute people. So,
well, okay. So now with 3 seconds of research, there is a famous constellation called Canis Major, which is called the Greater Dog. So there is a big one. It represents one of Orion's hunting dogs in Greek mythology. So I guess if I had spent a couple of seconds, and you guys have probably already tried to write this in the comment, doing that research, I would have realized that's probably what this is supposed to represent, but is not clear to the reader.
No. Like I say, none of the constellations are named apart from in the promotional material. So I think maybe it's not a constellation. Maybe it's just a get out of this thing. I don't know. It doesn't matter. It looks great.
It does, yes.
The star creatures are yellow and white, but the black shadowy bits are done a bit like Donna Troy's Starfield costume. So, you know, so you get that kind of, you know, that otherworldly, outer spacey kind of look.
It looks phenomenal. I hadn't thought about the Donna Troy aspect. That's great. And I do love that, like you mentioned, Jay is sort of out of his depth and he's not sure what to do next. And so he spends his time saving people, which again is something you don't see that often in superhero comics. It's more fight, fight, fight. Here he's running around saving the innocents, which is great because you want to see that from your heroes.
Yeah. And shall we shout out, this is an era where sound effects were very much to the fore. You quite rightly said, you know, there's this spang as a girder hits Jay in the back. But every page has got blams and slurps and swooshes and all sorts of amazing sound effects. So, yeah, it's again, a bit of a retro feel, but, you know, just adds to the fun of it, really.
Absolutely. Now, we got to talk about Vandal Savage. I mean, the mysterious bad guy. And maybe it's because I remembered it. Like, I don't remember a time where I didn't know who the bad guy for this was. You know, maybe it's because I had read the Direct Currents. Maybe it's because it was obvious. Maybe I just have forgotten the mystery of it. I don't know. But was there ever any mystery to you who the bad guy was?
But maybe when I first read it, because I had no knowledge, but now I read it and go, a title that says, Beware the Savage Skies, I think I know what I'm going to get into. So, Vandal Savage, as this sort of, I mean, we're assuming that he's the kind of doomsayer hippie at the start. We think he's setting Ted Knight up here, don't we? Because he gives the star chart that leads Ted to look down the telescope and bring the living constellation down. But it's a bit of a weird choice for 1950, because I don't think hippies were a thing until another 10 years later. So that's a bit strange. And then this weird sort of disguise that he's got. He's very, very white-haired, but Vandal Savage has a big black beard. So what did they do? Did they colour the bit? Perhaps that's why they had a week between the events and then Flash showing up. He needed to spend a week getting the white powder out of his beard in order to go back to normal appearance. Who knows? That's That's a bit strange.
In issue two, because, yeah, my big question looking at this was, who was this old man who gives him the star map? And then in issue two, there is a scene where Vandal Savage tells Ted how he manipulated the whole thing, and you see him set down a costume beard.
Okay.
So I'm assuming, but this doesn't look anything like Vandal Savage. I mean, this is an old, very skinny, scrawny, withered old man. This doesn't, Vandal Savage looks like a young man or youngish man, maybe his 40s at worst, in his prime. He's very stocky normally. He's very well built. And so this is hard for me to buy that he's this crazy old man. Now, I didn't see this guy as a hippie, but I can see what you're saying now, is he does have like the flare or frayed boots or whatever. But I see them as the end is nigh kind of character. Now, I don't know when that started. I don't know if that was before the 50s or not, but
I don't know.
But either way,
he's got a very, I mean, poncho would be generous. It's more like he's wearing a rug.
Absolutely. He looks like, it's one of those sort of poncho rugs. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I do think it's funny that the speaker, the announcer guy, is so distraught by the fact that this old man has interrupted it. He starts speaking very, very quickly, which is a great nod to the letterer, who did this fantastic job just running all the words together, but enough so with enough emphasis that we can still read what he's trying to say. Just, I thought that was a great touch by the letterer to make it look like this guy's super nervous and talking super fast.
Yes. They're obviously thrown out. They were not expecting any sort of trouble at this rather sedate opening. And suddenly they've got this crazy guy disrupting everything. Yeah, love it. It's really good. Again, you know, just good craftsmanship, isn't it?
Yeah. And of course, working for him, as you hinted, was Solomon Grundy. We see a hand, as you mentioned, an albino hand hit Jay. And then later on, we actually see Solomon Grundy's face and his trademark sort of black ripped up jacket. So we know Solomon Grundy's involved, which is always fun.
He's got a kind of Frankenstein's monster look here, but he hasn't really done anything yet. But I think, if memory serves, he's going to have a bigger role with the Black Canary story.
Correct. Yep. And as we joked, Vandal Savage clearly has a problem with American television. Specifically, I can tell it's I Love Lucy, because they show a giant heart, which is what they put the I Love Lucy logo across. But he gets so mad, he uses the gravity rod, which apparently doesn't have much power left anyway, and destroys that television. Poor Lucille Ball. So sad.
I thought this was a really good opening issue to a mini series. I don't think it's, in many ways, it's, in one particular way, it's very flashy, but in other ways, it's just very solid, very workmanlike. It's a really good opening salvo on this book, and I think, you know, sets up the rest of the story really well.
And I felt sort of similarly that when I reread it a couple of years ago, I was like, okay, that was fine. And then when you do stuff for a podcast, you analyze the crap out of these things. I mean, I've read this comic 3 times this week and then spent a bunch of time with it. And I've realized how much I really enjoy this comic. I think it's put together really well. I think Len Strazewski and along with Rich Burchett planned out a very well done story, extremely effective. As you said, it sets everything up. It gives you all the pieces. It leaves you with a cliffhanger of, you know, Flash has been defeated. You've got the power grid collapsing. So I think I feel like it's a fantastic setup for an 8-issue miniseries. So it's really, really good.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, out of your 5 heroes, both Flash and Starman are now effectively out of action. So you're already starting on the back foot.
Yep. And also we should mention that the last page is showing that pretty much the power grid for the entire United States is going down. So that's part of Vandal Savage's plan, is to throw the United States into the Dark Ages. In fact, the final shot, and I had to look this up, I didn't know this, the final shot is him watching his second television. I am curious to see how many he has by the end of the series, but he's watching his second television, and there's a guy singing on there, "So Long for a While," that's all the songs for a while, and I had to look that one up. That is the song from a show called Your Hit Parade, which was on TV from 1950 to 1959. So obviously they took the effort to find this, you know, the specific details. So nod to Strazewski and Burchett to find that. And just funny things about the show. So it was famously sponsored by Lucky Strike Cigarettes, as you may recall. Oh. But anyway, so they always sang that song at the end of the episode to say goodbye. And then the next week would come back with new popular songs they'd sing.
Okay. I mean, it does have the look of a sort of network shutdown type thing, doesn't it?
You know? Yeah, absolutely.
But I didn't realize it was a specific show. Oh, that's great.
So either way, fantastic issue. Now, if you have the physical copy, you then, and you referenced this earlier, you get, what is it, 2-3 pages here? Secret, or it says the secret origin of a miniseries, but in truth, it's this not quite so secret origin of the JSA. It talks about the sort of the publishing history of the JSA and why they're so important. Talks about, you know, All-Star Comics number 3, gets all the way to All-Star Comics 57. Then it talks about how they came back and they were part of the JSA-JLA crossovers and things like that. They talk about All-Star Squadron. It's a nice history for someone who doesn't know much about the JSA, which is probably perfect for you, telling you sort of this where they come from and why they're relevant.
Yeah, I mean, it's that old adage, isn't it? You know, every issue is somebody's first. Well, you know, this was my first. And again, if JSA hadn't been around for, you know, 5-10 years, actually giving the readers a little bit of a potted history. And, you know, it's not just the sort of stories, but it's more the kind of publishing history as much of that as anything. Really super helpful.
Yeah,
love it.
So this article sort of points out that it's sort of interesting. Across the 5 decades, there's really only been 6 principal writers of the JSA. You know, of course, you got Gardner Fox, who wrote the first stuff. Then you get Robert Kaniger, who wrote a few. John Broome wrote several. Then you flash forward to 1976. Jerry Conway comes in. He writes the All-Star Comics Revival. Paul Levitz then steps in to take over for that. And then, of course, Roy Thomas writes All-Star Squadron Infinity Inc. So there you go. 6 writers across 5 decades. And then, of course, Len Strzuski joins the crew.
Yeah. Those were the days when you had a solid gig. Hey.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I mean, think about it. You know, Strzuski got 18 issues out of it. So you know, he had 2 short runs, but he got 18 issues out of it, a year and a half worth of work. Now, it's interesting. This JSA piece, incredibly informational. I think I probably learned a whole bunch from this piece about the JSA myself because I still didn't know a lot of the publishing history. If you read this in the letters page, it looks like it's written by Mike Gold, one of the editors. Mm. However, in fact, if you read The Demise of Justice trade paperback, they have reprinted this entire publishing history of the JSA, and they point out that it was actually written by Mark Waid, which makes a lot of sense because Mark Waid used to write pieces like this. He wrote a piece like this in the back of the Aquaman miniseries as well, where I learned a lot of the publishing history for Aquaman. So Mark Waid was cranking out a lot of these kind of things.
Yeah. I mean, it's right in his wheelhouse, isn't it? The history of DCU. Mark, could we just have 500 to 600 words on the history of the JSA? Sure, no problem.
Right. Probably didn't even need a reference book, knowing him.
Yeah. When do you need it by? Tonight? You know?
Exactly. All right. All right. Well, now, Chris, this is the part of the show where we're going to award the All-Star Award. This is where we nominate our favorite moment from the issue, whether it's a story beat, something in the art, something made us laugh, whatever it might be. Both myself and Chris are going to pick one moment each to spotlight, and those will each earn an All-Star Award. Chris, you're the guest, so why don't you go first?
So, terrific episode, terrific issue, lots of great stuff. But I think for me, the emotional heart of this is the breaking of Ted Knight. You know, so it is the, you know, the reveal that he's been put into a wheelchair, the page after where we see him, you know, literally towered over by Vandal Savage, you know, smacked around by Solomon Grundy. It's that breaking of Ted Knight that for me is the emotional beat that sort of carries on forward into the rest of it. So that's my nominated moment.
That's a great one. And mine is sort of similar, tied into it. Mine is the same page, page 6, which is, we called out earlier, it's the first time Flash shows up in the issue. Mm. We see him, again, he's just run cross country before Ted can even hang up the phones, which is a great moment. You see their friendship, you see them reconnecting after not seeing each other for a while, and then you get the heartbreak that Ted has been injured so severely. So I was going to nominate that whole page, so it overlaps with yours, so there we go. Yeah.
Lovely. Those 2 pages, that's the bit. That's the moment.
There we go. There's great moments, folks. And now we want to hear what your All-Star Award pick for this issue would be. So go out to our comments. And in fact, when you write your comments on the website, I will read them on the show. And Chris, just like that, I need to ask a favor. Would you mind hanging out here for a bit to help Vandal Savage find his love for the 1950 sitcoms like I Love Lucy while I read the feedback?
Incinerated TV set, you've got some splaining to do, Vandal.
Oh my gosh. Wow, well played, sir. Now, don't worry, Chris, we'll bring you back at the end of the show. But after this podcast promo break, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called The Society Pages.
And action! It's Fade Out. Hosted by film fanatic Rob Kelly and a roster of special guests, Fade Out will examine the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Yeah. For more than 60 years, Dr. Victor Von Doom has been portrayed in comic books as a villain. But one podcast has been brave enough to challenge this narrative and present the man as the misunderstood anti-hero he truly is. I'm Professor Allen, and the podcast is Doom Speak. On the show, we present a more balanced view of Marvel's most maligned monarch. Over the years, we've covered his adventures in titles such as Iron Man, Doom 2099, Astonishing Tales, Silver Sable, and occasionally the title dedicated to his most persistent antagonists, Fantastic Four. If you believe that there's more behind the man behind the mask than the fake news at Big Comic wants you to think, then Doom Speak may be the podcast for you. Doom Speak can be found on all major podcast platforms as a part of the Relatively Geeky network feed and at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Give the show a listen. And hail Doom!
The Society Pages. The Society Pages is the segment of the show where we cover your feedback from the previous episode. Now, as I always say, folks, get out on the social media, find us at JSA Presents, because it's always about building a community of online JSA fans around the show. But remember, if you want your comments read on the air, be sure to leave those on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. Now, we'll start off, as usual, with our iTunes and Apple Podcast reviews, and as I always ask, if you haven't left one yet, please consider it. It really helps to raise the profile of the show and attract new listeners. You can look on iTunes or Apple Podcasts for Justice Society Presents. Now, if you're outside of the United States and you leave me an iTunes review, please just let me know. Otherwise, I won't see reviews unless I filter to that specific country. And as a thank you, I'll read your entire iTunes Apple Podcast review on the air. So, our thanks today goes out to Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He writes, "Best going today. I truly found my joy when I discovered this network. Such great shows. I enjoy everything you guys do, from Bwahaha to the JLUcast to Fantastic Four. I anxiously await every new episode. The hosts are amazing as well. Shag's goofy lightheartedness, Chris and Cindy's twang, and even Rob's curmudgeonness makes every show great. Keep up the great work. I'm here for all of it. And remember, Mort's rock." Well, thank you, Bucky749. We appreciate that. And remember, folks, you can look for Justice Society Presents on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. Now, I've collected all of your feedback from the last episode and all the comments I could find on social media, and I put it into one big Google document, and it's very, very long. So obviously, I'm not going to be able to read every word, but I'm going to try to acknowledge every single person that left a comment on the website and read a portion of that. So this is covering the previous episode featuring our holiday discussion with Starman number 27 with my guest Jose Rivera and Flash number 73 with my guest Steve Givens. So first up is Dave Tomko from the New Earth 2 website. That's newearth2.com. He promoted our last holiday episode on his site, which was very kind. But then, excitingly, we made the New Earth 2, quote, JSA Best of 2025 countdown. Here's what he wrote on his website. He said, "I'd be remiss if I didn't include the Justice Society Presents podcast feed from the Fire & Water Podcast Network. This collection of shows directly inspired me to restart this blog. This also sent me to the DC Universe Infinite to revisiting series I'd previously only read in fragments from back issue bins. Reading along with JSA in the 90s and the Irredeemable Shag and his guests revisiting the original 90s Justice Society of America ongoing series was a genuine joy. His spotlight episode on the Spectre pushed me to revisit John Ostringer and Tom Mandrake's run, while The Sandman Slept Here with Paul Keehan, Max Romero, and Ryan Daly made rereading Sandman Mystery Theater arc by arc an absolute treat. And in Chris and Cindy's Mr. and Mrs. Superman, which has me questioning how many Earth 2 Superman stories I've missed over the years, and this feed becomes essential listening. If you're even remotely interested in the JSA, you should already be subscribed." Wow, Dave, thank you so much. That was incredibly kind of you. Such generous praise that you heaped upon us. I don't know if we can live up to that, but thank you so much. That was so kind of you. All right. Up next, we heard from Paul Keehan from the Firewire Podcast Network. He has shows such as DC Special Cast, and he's part of the crew covering The Sandman Slept Here right here on the JSA Presents feed. Paul writes, great show and great stories by the guests. Weirdly, you were talking about the 1951 version of A Christmas Carol. My father-in-law is visiting, and we just watched that one last night. There we go. Some nice serendipity, Paul. Very cool, and happy holidays. Then we hear from Bruno Diaz from Uncle Bruno's Customs. So last episode when we covered Flash, we had this discussion about Jay Garrick swooping in with all these doctors to help deliver a baby. And there was a little bit of discussion between Steve and I about whether the doctors would have known what was going on because Jay zooming them in so quickly. So this is what Bruno wrote. While you were confirming that you meant that Jay wouldn't have had time to explain the situation of the doctors, the initial comments about how he could have gotten the correct doctor so fast reminded me of a scene in JLA number 193. It was the first comic I'd seen Firestorm in, and I didn't know who he was. Barry Allen tosses a Rubik's Cube in the air, runs to Central City Penitentiary, checks on Tio Morrow's cell, then reads the prison records to discover Morrow had been missing, then ran back to Manhattan in time to catch the cube. Firestorm was incredulous, and Wonder Woman placed her hand on Ronnie's shoulder, saying, Firestorm, why do you think they call him the fastest man alive? This is still the greatest example of how fast speedsters are in my mind. Bruno, I gotta tell you, man, that panel lives rent-free in my mind. I don't know if you know, but I ran a Firestorm website for about seven, eight years and ran the Firestorm podcast and things like that. So I'm a big fan of Firestorm. Those pages have always been fantastic, and I'll never forget them. So I'm glad you thought of those, too. Bruno writes, secondly, I didn't see the star on the tip of the church indicating that was a trope, especially because in a small box on the splash page it says, dedicated to Denny O'Neill, who wrote him best. Granted, I feel that was because I recently listened to the DC Special Cast where they covered the Denny O'Neill pen story where the star appeared over the manger and pointed out the bad guy to Batman, saving the day. I'd go so far as to say that's the all-star moment of the book in conjunction with Denny O'Neill's mention. That's really nice, Bruno. I hadn't thought of that potential connection. Then he says, lastly, I recall the first time I watched the Justice League animated episode Comfort and Joy and seeing Wally try to get a DJ Rubber Duck and wondering if it inspired in part by the story of Wally trying to find a gift for Linda. You know, Bruno, actually, as I went in to go read that Flash story that I mentioned about Wally trying to get a gift, in my head, I thought it was directly connected to the Rubber Ducky story in Comfort and Joy, because Comfort and Joy is one of the greatest Justice League cartoons ever, I think. And anyway, I really thought there was a connection there as well. I don't know if I mentioned it on the air. I have no idea. I don't remember. But I'm glad you saw the connection as well. All right, up next is Chris Franklin from the Firewater Podcast Network. Along with his wife, he hosts shows such as Mr. and Mrs. Superman, which is right here on the JSA Presents feed. They do JLUcast, and they used to do the Starman Chronicles, which we referenced last time. And, of course, they do a lot more than that, too. But Chris says, great episode and wonderful guests. It was a pleasure to hear Jose talk about Starman, because I know he's a huge fan. I feel a bit guilty that Cindy and I have dropped the ball on the Starman Chronicles, and I appreciate the kind words. But the reason is, as Shag pointed out, that is one dense series. It's difficult to cover in a manner that seems worthy and fitting. We covered the issues on, meaning the one we covered, the Christmas issue, on Supermates years ago, and it's definitely one of my favorite holiday comics, and I love revisiting it here. Oddly enough, Ryan, Captain Entropy, and myself just discussed another Steve Yoel-drawn Christmas comic on Batman Nightcast. It must be Steve Yoel week! And Chris goes on to say, it's always a pleasure to hear Steve talk about The Flash. I'm in the same boat with him on this issue. I bought it off the stands at the local Begley's Drug, where my future mother-in-law worked, and was flipping through it before buying it. The last page nearly knocked me to the floor. At the time, I kind of wanted Barry to come back, but after Wade made Wally the Flash with this very story, I wish he'd stayed dead for good. Then Jose Rivera responded directly to Chris. Jose was our guest last episode and also the author of The Underground Adventures. Jose says, Chris, you are always a class act, man. Shang said it and you reiterate it. Starman is a dense series. I'd like to go back to it once a year, not only for the story, but also to remind myself what inspired me all those years ago to want to get serious about writing. And yeah, it's a lot to process, especially around Stars My Destination. And then he says, sometimes I still listen to those old Starman Chronicles episodes of yours, and it makes me happy. Yeah, I just want to chime in here to both Jose and Chris. The guys, the Starman Chronicles series that Chris and Cindy did is absolutely excellent. You can find that over in the Supermates feed. There's one episode here on JSA Presents. And Chris, there's absolutely no reason to feel any guilty about the fact that, you know, it's a challenge, right? I mean, podcasting's hard, folks. It may seem easy. It's a lot of work. And especially when you're, tackling such dense material like Starman. So Chris, instead of feeling guilty, feel the triumph of everything you guys did. Because those episodes still exist. They're still out there for people to listen to and enjoy. I really re-listened to one not too long ago myself, and it's a great run and something you should be proud of. All right, so back to Jose's comments. He says, with the Flash issue, I remember reading it and loving the fact that Jay and Wally were sharing a story. I've always had an affinity for Jay Garrick, even when I didn't know a lot about him. He was the original Flash, and that was enough to get me excited to read a story with him in it. Then we're here for Brett Miller, who says, the issue of Starman is my favorite holiday comic. The best part was Hope meeting Charity and laughing about how the Trinity is complete. Faith, Hope, and Charity. It's those moments that made this book feel so real. That is a great moment, Brett. Then we're here from Tim Price from the Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders podcast, which is becoming Outcasters Under Siege. Tim says, so to lose all my nerd cred, I haven't read the entire Starman series. I did get the first year or two in the final year, but that's about it. It is on my to-read list, but as noted, its denseness has kept it on hold. But if a podcast gives me an excuse to read along, I'll jump at it. That all means that this is my first time reading this issue, and dang, why is it so dusty in here, making my eye water? Excellent choice for a seasonal episode. And a great issue of The Flash. Of course, I have this entire run, but it's fun with this issue being Mark Waid's first year on Flash. If only he'd known where it would lead to today, right? Tim goes on, he says, he just hit the ground running on that series and never stopped. It's just so good. I did have a thought, though, about Jay bringing the doctors and nurses. I choose to believe Jay personally or professionally knows the people he brought. He had the personality that I can see befriending all kinds of people in Keystone or even a network of rescues who are willing to, quote, pay it forward when he needs them. Tim, that's a great suggestion. I love that. It makes a lot of sense, too. Then he says, now, I think it was touched on that the pregnant woman's name was Maria, but not sure if it was commented on that the husband's name, Joey, is an on-the-nose play on Joseph. So yes, Waid went all in with the metaphors here. Honestly, Tim, I don't know if we mentioned it last episode, and I didn't put it together. Maria and Mary and Joseph and Joey. Wow. Yeah, you're right. Right on the nose. Then we heard from Bucky749, the American Samurai, who has his own YouTube channel. He says, funny, you said Marvel versus DC. And in the past couple of weeks, I've been wearing my Green Lantern Zippy hoodie to work, and I use a Marvel backpack for work. Thought you'd enjoy that. There you go. You're your own team up there, Bucky. Then we heard from Super Captain, who says, great show. One of these days, I will read more of Robinson Starman. I think I've read the first trade and really liked it, but I simply haven't picked up more. Robinson is someone who has written some fabulous comics, particularly The Golden Age, and I know the Starman and Leave It to Chance are both really well regarded, and worked on the awesome Stargirl TV series, and he wrote the Cry for Justice miniseries. I find most of his work to be somewhere in between those two extremes. Then he goes on to say, man, the Flash family has some pretty good Christmas comics. There is this one, and then the Present Tense story, which you mentioned, in which Wally tries desperately to remember and search the world for what Linda wanted for Christmas. Also, there's No Bart, There Is No Santa Claus, a nice little impulse story where Max tries to convince Bart that Santa isn't real, and Bart points out that in a world where superpowers exist, why is it so hard to believe in Santa? Secret headquarters, red suit, travels at super speed. What's so improbable about that? Oh, Super Captain, I had not thought of that impulse story in years. That is so funny. That is a great one. Thanks for the happy memories. Then we're from Sean Ross from the Firewater Podcast Network. He has a show called Peacebounded Down, a Wonder Woman podcast. He says, great episode, guys. I love Steve Yoel's artwork on the Starman issue, which is surprising because I'm usually not a fan of his work on mainstream series. I always see him more as an indie or Vertigo artist. You know, Sean, I'm right there with you. I always think of him with Sebastian O, which is a Vertigo book. And Sean says, this brings up a question. Do you have an artist or writer whose work you typically aren't a big fan of that knocked it out of the park for you on a specific issue or story arc? It's a good question. I'm going to answer it in a second, folks, but I'd be interested to hear what you at home say. Sean says, I have a specific example in mind. I tend not to enjoy the work of Brian Azzarello, finding it too dark and cynical for my taste. So imagine how surprised I was when I really enjoyed his take on Wonder Woman, the New 52. Now, mind you, it has a brilliant art by Cliff Chang, which didn't hurt, but he still deserves credit for an imaginative run. Love the Starman coverage. All right, folks, so again, the question from Sean is, do you have an artist or writer whose work you typically aren't a big fan of that knocked it out of the park for you on a specific issue or arc? Again, I want to hear your thoughts at home. I'll go ahead and share one now. Folks, go ahead and brace yourself for a shocker, and I guess I'm going to have to brace myself for a bunch of hate mail. I am not a very big fan of the art of Frank Quitely. I know somebody at home just went, because they love his stuff, and I'm sorry. I'm not saying he's a bad artist. I'm just saying it's not for me. However, I will say he absolutely knocked it out of the park on the JLA Earth 2 graphic novel that came out many, many years ago, written by Grant Morrison. It's where the JLA meets like a version of the Crime Syndicate. The art in there is amazing. So for me, that's one of those where he knocked it out of the park. But his other stuff doesn't really grab me. So, folks, your turn at home. Let us know. All right, then Martin Gray from the Too Dangerous for Girl blog chimes in and says, I love the Starman series too. Bought it as it came out and have it all in trades. This was an especially nice story. I'm such a sucker for sentiment. In regards to the phrase, in my cups, it's honestly not a phrase you hear in the UK unless you're watching Shakespeare. I guess Faith was put in an old world mood by all the pseudo-Dickens flirting with her hubby Clarence. There we go. Okay, Martin, that helps. Thank you for that explanation. And he says, and we get a classic Flash issue 2. Goodness me, I remember being excited when that last page came along. Wally was doing great, but I hated the horror of Barry's death. His dying all over the DCU, shriveling, and then properly snuffing it with no heroes around to bear witness, so I was glad to see him back. As for this issue's main business, it was a lovely, fluffy fair. And he says, Shag, I'm surprised to hear you knew Barry was coming back. My memory was that it was a massive surprise. Maybe comic shop staff were told? Martin, I don't know. You know, maybe I have a false memory. Like, in my, I always read the Previews magazine. I was a diehard reader of Previews magazine. And I feel like, I mean, we would have known 2 or 3 months in advance what was coming. I feel like I either knew or figured that Barry was coming. Maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe I'm way off base here. Maybe I just imagined that retroactively. I don't know. That's my memory, but, you know, hey, sometimes I have a Swiss cheese memory like Dr. Sam Beckett. So, all right. Then just a few shout-outs to John Stibe. He helped promote the show. He says, it's almost Christmas, and what better way to celebrate than with Christmas comics? Santa Shag and Friends unwrap Sarman number 27 and Flash number 73 and spread a little holiday cheer. Thanks, John, for sharing that. Then when Joe Tonello commented, because we talked about Jack Knight just being gone after the series, he may have appeared one or two times, Joe says, Jack did make a recent appearance in the current run of JSA with a shot of him from behind in a field with his son. I think it was JSA issue number 8 in 2023. Well, thank you, Joe. Then Anthony Cardino says, I've only recently started listening to JSA Presents. I started at the beginning, so I've made it just tonight to your JSA in the 90-0 episode. Well, Anthony, I hope you're still listening, and by the time you hear this episode, glad to have you here. Brad Dade says, I can't believe you mentioned Firearm from the Ultraverse. I thought I was the only person to felt like it was similar to Starman. Amazing, underrated series. Yeah, Brad, absolutely loved Firearm. Glad you did too. Then we're from Jordan Jennings from Extremely Uncanny and the host of the podcast Never Ending Battle. He says, fantastic, just caught up with the show and I'm eager to hear your coverage of the 1991 miniseries. Well, Jordan, I hope this episode didn't disappoint. Then Comic Foil, and this was great. He said, I love hearing Shag and Jose mention at the start of this podcast that they're both fans of the Will Payton Starman series. But did they recreate the cover to issue number 7 using clay and paint in their senior year high school art class project? I might be the only one. So seriously, folks, if you go out on Blue Sky, you'll find this. Comic Foil posted a picture where he literally recreated the cover of the Will Payton Starman issue number 7, literally recreated in clay and paint. It must have been fired in a kiln and all this stuff. It looks great. And he posted that in a cover of Starman number 7 on Blue Sky. I absolutely adore it. Comic Foil, you are a madman and so cool. All right. Now, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared our show on their social media time to really help promote the show, right? This is going to Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. And yes, I know this every month, folks. It is a long list of names, and it's probably boring to listen to, but these folks helped show their support and promote the show. So it's important to me that we recognize these individuals. This is the only time we're going to mention DC Retro Cabal, but you know what? They're part of our community that helped promote the show, and so they're family. So this time out, we got over 75 people who helped promote the last episode of the show. Now, you could be on this list next month. It's just as easy by sharing or retweeting or re-skeeting, which sounds terrible, or whatever it's called, on Facebook or Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, or Threads. So our thanks go out to Alan Boyce Jr., Andrew Redheaded Fanboy, Barry Reese's Infinity Ink Tumblr, Batman Nightcast, Between the Pages Blog, Billy D., Brad Dade, Brett Young, Brian Schufo, Chris Field from Otherverse Games, Chris Mort, Clinton Robinson, Codex Omniversa, Comic Foil, Craig McD, D. Kennedy at Detective 38, Dan Dougherty, Dave's Comic Hero Blog, DC Dave, DC New Earth 2, DC Retro Cabal, DC Special Cast, Del Dracula, Derek Crabb, Dr. Ange, Dr. Pop Culture USA, Ed Moore, Eugene Hoyle, Extremely Uncanny, Gotham by Geeks, Grumpy Old John, Gus Casals, Jason R. Lady, Joe Tonello, John S. McNamara, John Stibe, Jordan Jennings, Justin Steiner, Keechy Baker, Lizanne Oswald, Lucien Desar, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Sorois, Mike Jameson, Mike Thomas, Mo Walker, Nuno Duarte, Outcasters, a Batman and the Outsiders podcast, Paul Kean, Paul Wildenberger, Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Relatively Geeky podcast, Rick Lee James, Rob Kelly, Robert Junker, Ryan Daly, Scott X, Sean Manning, Sean Ross, Silverman on Security, S. Matthew Stolte, Steve Gibbons, Stephen E. Shend, Stop, Let's Team Up, Superman Always, The Bat Pod, The Earth 2 Podcast, The Telltale Mind, Tim Price, Turn-Based Mindset, Uncle Bruno's Customs, Venkman, Watch This Space, Willie Yarbrough, and Zek Cap Boots. Wow. Folks, thank you so much for your support of the JSA in the 90s podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, and the community of JSA fans we're building together is just fantastic. I adore all of you. This is one of my favorite things to record every single month. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Jose Rivera or Steve Gibbons. I do my best to find all the social media comments, but sometimes they do slip through my fingers. So please keep those cards and letters coming, and remember, the best way to be part of the show is on our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA. Leave your comments on the show post there, and your fellow JSA fans can interact with you, you can communicate, and I will read them on the air. Now, you can also find us on most social media platforms as JSA Presents, including Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, X or Twitter, and Threads. Or you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. And my thanks again to you listeners for such an awesome collection of feedback. I hope everyone's had a good new year so far, and I'm so thrilled to listen. And you know what? If you're still listening at this point, a special message to you. You are the committed, dedicated listeners who listen to every bit of the show and not skip over the feedback. I really appreciate that, and I'm sure the people who leave feedback appreciate that too. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll connect with this episode's guest, Dr. Chris Lewis, and we'll see how he managed with Vandal Savage.
It is critical you pay attention at this time.
Ready to blast off into Marvel's Novaverse? Join Xandar Radio, a Nova podcast, your ultimate destination for everything Nova. I'm Doug Smith, producer and co-host of Xandar Radio. We bring you news, deep dive reviews, fan spotlights, creator interviews, and epic roundtable discussions. Whether you're a diehard fan of Annihilation, The New Warriors, or love the various Nova runs, this is your show. So grab your Nova helmet, power up, and tune in at novaprimepage.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Xandar Radio, because the Nova Corps needs you.
Attention, attention all personnel. New from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, it's MASHcast. Hosted by MASH mega fan Rob Kelly and a rotating cast of VIPs, MASHcast analyzes, episode by episode, the greatest television series of all time, MASH. Find MASHcast on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Jocularity!
All right, folks, we're back from breaking. Yes, we have Chris back with us. Chris, thank you again for appearing on this episode. I knew when I asked you, you were going to be fantastic. I didn't know it was your first JSA comic, so how perfect is that? Why don't you tell the listeners at home where they can find more of you out there in the world?
Well, I've been on the network. I haven't recorded. I've realized I haven't done a podcast for a little while, but I've just done a special end of year episode of Fade Out with Rob and Dr. Ange, which was a very fast canter through the movies we saw last year, 2025. I think you said, Shag, you tend to listen to podcasts at double speed. I would listen to that one at half speed because boy, do we talk fast. and I think as this episode comes out, the three of us are going to be meeting up again to record another episode of MASH. And it's one that Ange and I are really excited about because it's particularly medical themed, some proper surgery. We've got lots to medically geek out about, and we might even let Rob get a word in edgeways. So thank you very much for inviting me to discuss and relive this episode of JSA. And Impact Comics, if you ever need a guest for Comic Cast, I'm well up for that.
Well, and folks, if you want to hear more of Dr. Chris, he's been on a lot of shows on the network. You've been on a Doctor Who episode with me. You did two episodes of the Justice League International Blahaha podcast. So he's on the network quite often, and I'm sure we'll have him back again at some point as well. And thank you, Chris. I really appreciate you being here.
That's a pleasure. Always lovely to talk to you.
Well, that's going to do it, folks. Come back next episode when we cover Justice Society of America number 2 from 1991. And I'll be joined by a fantastic guest to help me cover the issue. Who will it be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Chris.
And we're asking you to join the fight.
For justice.